Well, tonight's program is very important to me. Many years ago, my late aunt, Dr. Shafika Karegula, was dabbling with ESP. She was literally changing her entire psychiatric ability and practice into that of studying the mind, telepathy, ESP. She was obsessed with it. She got to know Ingo Swann, the remote viewer, very, very well. Tonight with Paul Smith, we will be talking about some new and exciting breakthroughs in ESP and questions about human consciousness. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. His name is Paul Smith. He's got degrees from BYU in the National Defense Intelligence College. Paul is a doctoral candidate in philosophy at the University of Texas at Austin. 20 years as an Army intelligence officer, spending 7 as a remote viewer for the military Stargate remote viewing program. Trained in remote viewing by the creators of remote viewing, Ingo Swann, whom I just mentioned, and Hal Puthoff. He was the primary author of the program's RV training manual, trained other well-known remote viewers, Lynn Buchanan, David Morehouse. Paul now teaches remote viewing commercially. His book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, was chosen as a book bonus feature and editor's choice by Reader's Digest, president of the not-for-profit International Remote Viewing Association, and is completing production on a course introducing military dowsing principles to all of us. Paul Smith, the guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hey, Paul, how are you?
I'm good. How about you, George?
I'm doing great. I'm doing real well. Hey, so tell me about the not-for-profit IRVA. What does everybody do when you get together?
We don't remote view. We try and educate people about remote viewing.
Okay, so it's not like you all band together and go, okay, let's find Osama bin Laden tonight.
No. We all do that on our own, presumably, right?
I've always suspected that.
Yeah. The International Remote Viewing Association, we put that together almost 10 years ago now. Myself, along with some of the legends of remote viewing, Hal Puthoff, Russell Targ, Skip Atwater, Lynn Buchanan, a number of other folks, just to kind of bring a little bit of sanity to the field, there are all kinds of claims and counterclaims about remote viewing. Remember, this was just a few years after it had become declassified.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seemed like we needed to come up with some kind of stabilizing influence, I guess, in a sense. And so we got together and created the organization, and it mainly exists for the moment to provide rational education about remote viewing, help people understand what is true about remote viewing and maybe be able to sort out the things that aren't true about it that keep getting said. We have annual conferences and have a website with a lot of information on it, and we try and bring into our conferences speakers of great interest to the community. In fact, this year, the conference is going to be in October, and people can find out about it by going to rvconference.org. And our keynote speaker is going to be the legendary Jacques Vallée.
Finally, he's coming out to talk again, huh?
Yes, and he isn't going to talk, at least I presume, he isn't going to talk so much about UFOs as about his experience with remote viewing, which is actually fairly extensive, which most people weren't aware of.
That's true.
Yeah, so we're real excited about that. He's a really nice guy. I've gotten to know him a bit, at least long distance over the phone in the past month or so. So
you think you can work on him, try to get him on the program with you?
I actually had that in the back of mind. I haven't brought it up with him yet.
All right. When you're ready, let's get it. And,
okay.
You know, do it before your conference. So, yeah. You know, we can mention that heavily in the program, too.
That would be great. I appreciate the opportunity.
He's very skittish on talking with UFOs, and we won't dwell on it with him, but I'd still like to get his views on it.
I think that's one of the reasons he's so respected, is because he is very careful about what he says and what he believes or claims to be true.
Well, he's the guy that Steven Spielberg depicted in his Close Encounters of the Third Kind. He was the French guy, basically.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing was, you remember those of you all out there who've seen Close Encounters, remember Richard Dreyfuss building Devil's Tower out of mashed potatoes.
Yes, and then chopping the top off it, right?
That is stage 6 in Ingo Swann's controlled remote viewing. Now, Jacques claims that he didn't have any direct influence on that scene, but nonetheless, it does have that striking resemblance to what I was actually taught in learning the CRV methodology so many years ago now.
Hey, Paul, we're going to talk a lot about ESP tonight, but I've got to ask you, how is Ingo Swann doing? Do you talk with him anymore?
I do off and on, and he's actually feeling pretty well. Last time I talked to him, he seemed to be feeling pretty well, so that's good. He has some issues to deal with in New York, and he's trying to resolve some things there, but don't have to do with health, thank goodness.
Good.
Good.
I'm always fascinated by that book he wrote, Penetration, and... You know, when he talks about how he ran into an alien in a grocery store, and also, more importantly, those, and I can't get this out of my mind, Paul, the structures that he saw on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just fascinating. You know, you and I talked a little bit about this in June when you were on for just a bit with Bill Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever remote view the moon to try to... I know what you're going to say because we've talked about this, but this for the Coast audience. Did you try to corroborate what Ingo saw?
Well, actually, I didn't try to, but that was the upshot of it.
You didn't know he was asking you to do that.
He was. He gave me a coordinate to remote view, and I didn't know what was up his sleeve. And when I got done with I don't know, I guess I did maybe three or four sessions for him. He then showed me. He sent me the final report that he was producing, and it contained information that both he and someone else had developed independently of anything that I had produced. And there were some very interesting similarities and correlations in the information that was provided. Which did seem, at least on the surface, at least, to show that that Ingo's suspicions or reports or whatever about some sort of artificial constructs on the surface of the moon, there might be some credibility to it.
That is it. But what we don't know is whether it's ET type or maybe our own Michael Cremo, who believes we're hundreds of millions of years old. I bet he would say those structures might have been built by man when they did their own explorations millions of years ago.
Well, as it stands right now, there's no way of telling. It would be nice if we could get a new manned lunar program going that would give us full disclosure about that and see what, if anything, really is there. That's really the only way to validate remote viewing data, is then after you're done with your work, then actually going and looking to see if you were right. And it would be really nice if we could go and look and see if we were right about that.
Indeed. And in your book, Reading the Enemy's Mind, is it still available out there at the bookstores, Amazon?
It's certainly available on Amazon, and you can still find it at Barnes & Noble. It's around. Yeah, it's still in print.
All right. Well, ESP, tell me about these exciting breakthroughs. In what's going on here?
Well, lay a little background. We've talked about this before, too. A while back, the CIA finally declassified a lot of the documents that had to do with the program that we now know as Stargate, the remote viewing program.
Mm-hmm.
And it had many more dimensions than just remote viewing. Of course, there was a lot of research involved with it. Fort Meade didn't do so much of the research, although the military part of it, but certainly a lot went on out at SRI and later on SAIC. A lot of that is now available in the archives that the CIA finally released. Well, over the years, I've been digging through those things and sorting things out, and I've come across a lot of the previous research papers, okay, that have to do with other aspects than just remote viewing. So that's the background. There's some information there that I was able to dig out that it was not widely known, in fact, was probably not known to most people and still isn't. And some of that had to do with what is commonly now known as dowsing.
And this is not like the old days, people looking for water.
No. This is the problem, of course, with remote viewing, and again, this is refreshing people's memories. The problem with remote viewing is, or any kind of psychic modality, as soon as somebody finds out that you're psychic, they want you to do one of two things. One is find something that's missing, and the other is to predict the future.
Right.
Well, both of those are very hard for remote viewing to do just because of its very nature. Now, it can help somewhat, and so it continues to be used today, remote viewing per se, used for what we call search, trying to find things. But it doesn't work great, and that was even known back as early as the early 70s, mid-70s, when the program was very new. The remote viewing program was very new.
Sure.
And so, but search being a very important thing for the military, they want to know where the bad guys are. They want to know where hostages are. They want to know where the weapons of mass destruction might be hidden and that sort of thing. Search very important. Remote viewing useful to some degree, but not enough. So what do we do? Well, the military contracted with SRI and some other folks to try and sort that out. And over the course of roughly about a decade, a number of different research efforts were done to try and solve what they called the search problem. And that was essentially it boiled down to often very sophisticated versions of what most people would think of as dowsing.
This is an incredible breakthrough that we're going to be talking about tonight because people can learn this, Paul.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. The interesting thing, of course, traditionally, if you talk to people who are involved in what we've come to know as the psychic arts, that there is this fiction that's been maintained for centuries, really, that in order to be a psychic, you have to have the gift, right? You have to be gifted. Well, one of the things that remote viewing has shown is that, in fact, that's not true. Anybody can learn it.
Now, anybody. I agree with that.
Anybody can learn it. Now, I have to be careful and say that some people learn it better than others.
Right.
For whatever reason that might be.
Some people put a block up, for example.
I think that affects it quite a bit. Yes, exactly. A good way of putting it. So it may not be that everybody can learn it as well as everybody else, but everybody to some degree can learn it. Now, obviously, there'll probably be a few extreme cases where people can't learn it at all. You know, there's probably people with certain disabilities and things like that. But overall,
it's like OBEs. You can teach people how to astral project. I can't do it. I've got a block up about that.
Yeah, unless it's happening to you and like at night or whatever, and
right.
You don't remember it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So anyway, that's very important. Anybody can learn it. Some of this research has shown is that dowsing, which for many years is kind of, well, for centuries, has had both its advocates and people who don't believe in it. Of course, that describes just about everything having to do with psychic arts, right? dowsing also can be taught and can be learned and can be developed. Now, that's some people will say, well, I told you that all along, but there's some new interesting developments present in the data, which then we have extended a bit as we try to employ dowsing and solving the search problem in actual practical applications of things since.
Now, let's go into the dowsing. Ramon Grace was our guest many months ago. He talks about that as well. He did it in the form of a pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
He believes that you, and I think it's almost like a lie detector test, but what he thinks is you can ask yourself questions with a yes or a no, and your subconscious mind will take over and will give you the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And is that basically your definition of dowsing, or is it something else?
Well, that's part of it. I want to throw in a caveat here. It won't necessarily will give you the answers. It can give you the answers.
It can, okay.
Yeah. It's like remote viewing. So it can give you a coordinate, and you can describe what's there. Doesn't necessarily mean you will describe what's there. And, of course, that's where the learning comes in, to be able to sort out real information, real responses from the mental noise that one encounters. Dowsing itself, I don't know, I should have thought of a good definition, but people, of course, know of dowsing. Generally, the cartoon of the old prospector out with a forked stick looking for water in the desert.
Yeah.
That's the image they get.
That's right? The old image.
Yeah. And, of course, that does reflect dowsing, one form of it. But it can be so much more sophisticated and so much more nuanced than that. And, in fact, most people's needs certainly don't involve finding water. Still, people need to find water today, but But the vast majority of people already got the water. And now they got to figure out what to do with their lives or how to solve problems or where to find things that are missing. And that's where dowsing can come in and play a valuable role in the things that we are involved in our lives.
Now, tell me about the new and exciting breakthroughs here. I mean, what's new about this thing?
Well, a couple, there are several things. First off, what's new for most people isn't necessarily new for myself and my colleagues at Fort Meade. We actually were making some of these discoveries back at when we were working operational projects for the military. But a lot of it will be new for people today who weren't part of that little highly classified operation. You might say they're newly revealed. But there are also some new things that were developed in the process of putting all this together, which I'll explain a little bit here in a moment.
Okay.
So there's new things of two different kinds, new revelations, but there's also new discoveries. So one of the things that only really a small number of people understand is the relationship between dowsing and remote viewing, which really has never actually been, I won't say never, but it very seldom ever been discussed, and I certainly don't think in public. I think some of the teachers like myself, Lynn Buchanan and folks like that, who have their own courses may teach that relationship because we learned it through actual hands-on practice 20 years ago. So that there's a very interesting and fairly close relationship between remote viewing and dowsing, which I don't know. Maybe now's a good time to go into it.
No, go ahead. We've got some. Okay. We've got a few minutes, but you've got 3 hours.
Okay, good. All right.
You're not going anywhere.
So, in a nutshell, the relationship between dowsing and remote viewing is, I like to refer to it as, an inverse relationship. So it's like this: in remote viewing, presumably the tasker, now the viewer is supposed to be blind, so we'll talk about the person giving the assignment. The tasker knows generally where the target is. What the tasker does not know is information about the target. They may know its identity, they may know where it is, but they may not know some information about it they want the remote viewer to find for them. And so the remote viewer is provided with the location, for example, latitude and longitude, geographic coordinates, and told to describe, and the tasker knows if the viewer's on because they're describing the actual target and then giving the information that hasn't yet been determined. So, in a way, you could say this. Remote viewing, you know what the target is and where it is. You just don't know about the target, right? In dowsing, you know the information about the target. You know what it is. You know why you want it. You just don't know where it is, okay? So, with remote viewing, you know where it is. In dowsing, you don't know where it is, okay?
All right.
And so in remote viewing, you're trying to find out information about it. In dowsing, you already have the information. You want to know where it's located.
And you also want a confirmation, don't you?
Yes, that can be the case as well. Now, of course, now I'm talking about locational dowsing. When we're dowsing for information, that's a somewhat different situation that we can get into a little bit later. Okay, so now that's inverse, that's a kind of a strange relationship to say that they're closely related. But here's where it all boils down. And this is something new that we didn't even really discuss at Fort Meade when we were using it. We were using dowsing, we just didn't think about how it integrated with remote viewing. The fact is, of course, and this is going to seem obvious to a lot of people, the fact is that both dowsing and remote viewing rely very heavily on subconscious processes. And in remote viewing, of course, the subconscious gains information, and the trick is to get that information up into conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm. And to somehow make it reasonable where you can understand it in pictures.
Yes, or even verbally. But in fact, yes, to make it understandable, exactly. In dowsing, it's already in your conscious mind. You're trying to get your subconscious to indicate where it is.
Hold right there, Paul. Yep. Right there. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Smith, reading the enemy's mind as we talk about remote viewing, dowsing, all of it under the umbrella of extrasensory perception. Ah, yes, and our special guest tonight, Paul Smith, reading the enemy's mind. And, of course, we're talking about these breakthroughs and ESP. So get ready for more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. We're with Paul Smith. Paul, we were right in the middle of talking about dowsing and some of this ESP work.
Yes. I was going over the idea, the similarities between remote viewing dowsing. In fact, it all had to do with subconscious. So here's the bottom line. When we were working with dowsing and integrating with remote viewing at Fort Meade, we, of course, were using it to try and locate things like hostages in the Middle East and Lebanon particularly. But more particularly, we used it, we had really kind of developed it more thoroughly. We were using it to try and work with the joint task forces in the war on narcotics. The war on drugs. Yeah. We were trying to find narco traffickers and contraband. They were tasking us, and we were trying to find it. Well, we actually had a number of successes, and we did it this way. We took remote viewing, and we would remote view blind on the target. Although I have to qualify that a little bit, we were supposed to be blind, but after you've done enough drug transporting ships and enough narcotics laboratories and stuff, you usually guess, oh, I'll bet this is another one of those. Anyway, we'd remote view them, and then when we got really deep into the session and had identified the target sufficiently, that's when we would use dowsing. We would start pulling our dowsing tools and lay things out and then proceed.
It's almost like a double whammy, Paul.
Well, in a way it was, and we didn't realize that we were in a way kind of inventing a new modality here. Now, remember I said in dowsing you know what the target is, but you just don't know where it is. Well, in this case, the viewer, being blind, didn't know what the target was and didn't know where it was either, okay, at least consciously in their conscious mind. And the reason we did it this way is because the viewer would remote view it, would start getting a really good connection, what we call a signal line, a really good signal line connection to the target, to the point where even though they couldn't name it and say, well, this is a certain ship or whatever, they could, right. They at least really kind of identified it. And then that supplied the first requirement for dowsing, which is to know what your target is, right? So then they would be launched into dowsing, starting from the position where you needed to know. The position that most dowsers do, knowing what the target is, just not knowing where it is. Now, here's why that was really good, is because since dowsing relies on the subconscious, because it's, for want of a better term, an intuitive or psychic kind of a discipline, if you remote view first, you already get yourself linked to the target in the first place. You already establish the connection that then the dowsing is going to exploit. And I think that probably is one of the reasons why we had some pretty good successes with dowsing in that environment. But the lesson we didn't really, forgive the expression, consciously draw from it, was how dowsing and remote viewing related at that level, which was that many of the same problems you run into with remote viewing as far as dealing with your conscious, the conscious-subconscious conflicts that you run into,
mm-hmm.
also are the things that keep dowsing from working very well. And so, in many cases, and so when you remote viewed first, then you already had worked through a lot of that stuff, so it didn't disturb the dowsing as much, and it allowed you to be more successful.
Why are we using the term ESP, extrasensory perception, for remote viewing and dowsing? I thought that was more of telepathy or something like that.
Well, let's look at it this way. I'll come back to the connection between remote viewing and dowsing here in a minute, but your question is really useful here. Let me lay a little background here. I've had some ongoing discussions with Ingo Swann over the years about terminology. Most people think terminology is kind of boring. They say, oh, it's all semantics. Who cares, right? Well, in fact, if you don't have clear terms as to what you're talking about, you're bound to have miscommunications and lack of understanding, and you see that happening all the time. And it really limits the progress of fields if you can't communicate in a common terminology. So people have tried to figure out over the years what exactly we're going to call this, right? Ingo and I have debated. He doesn't like the term parapsychology. He doesn't like the term paranormal. And the reason is because if what we're talking about, as we just did a few minutes ago, suggests that this is a common capability that anyone can develop if they just get the right training and do the right practicing. If it's a common thing, then it is psychology. It's not para anything. Okay? It's a parapsychology implies something beside or outside of,
right.
or next to or different from psychology. Well, if it's a normal human thing, it can't possibly be parapsychology.
It may be super psychology or something like that.
Well, maybe, yeah. It's something that is normal for humans, and so it isn't, at least, the very least, it isn't para. And the same thing with paranormal, obviously. Of course, now paranormal is a broader term than parapsychology, but nonetheless, when you talk about mental things as being paranormal, well, if this is a common human trait, a common human faculty, it's not outside of the norm. It is a normal thing. We just don't recognize that in our society. So he didn't like those terms at all, and I absolutely agree with him. We went back and forth on ESP. J.B. Rhine, the famous researcher who also used the term parapsychology a lot, he's the one, actually, at least as far as I've been able to trace, who invented the term extrasensory perception. And
Duke University.
Yes, exactly. And the reason he invented that term is because there were a lot of debates about terminology and trying to figure out what actually to call this thing. Well, if you think about extrasensory perception, in a way it really does describe what the heck we're doing here with remote viewing and dowsing. And the extra doesn't mean in addition to. The extra means outside of or away from. So we have extra, so outside of, sensory having to do with our senses, right?
All right.
So, but perception, of course, is what we want to do because that's how we get information as humans, is through our perceptual processes. So perception, but this is perception that is outside of or away from or beyond or without, whatever, the actual physical senses being involved.
Which we've all felt sometimes, whether we were intuitive or we had these hunches, we've all touched on it sometime in our lives.
Yes. And, you know, sometimes there are some sensory involvement in intuition that comes in below the liminal threshold in the subconscious. But also with intuition is exactly what you've touched on here, is that much of intuition appears to be coming through a channel that doesn't involve the senses, okay? And, of course, to science, that's just absolutely ridiculous. Any kind of information coming into the human being has to involve the senses in one way or another.
And some scientists also, Paul, would tie it merely to the brain function, mm-hmm. and you and I both believe it's outside of that realm.
Yeah, well, it includes the brain, obviously, but it does transcend it. I think that's...
And the reason why you and I believe that is because when you die, the brain's done. It's decaying. It's over. This still exists.
It certainly seems to, and I believe that for certain, yes. So that means it obviously has to be extrasensory because your eyes aren't seeing anything anymore once you're dead.
That's right. We don't think, at least.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem plausible that they. Certainly after you've been dead long enough, they're not going to see anything.
Paul, what if everybody who is buried is basically still conscious in their body? Oh God.
That sounds like an Edgar Allan Poe story.
I mean, they put them in coffins, and they're still, for the forever, they're alert, but they just can't get out.
Oh. Well, yeah, that's an awful thing to think about.
It was so bad, my engineer just left. He couldn't handle it. I'm here alone now.
Oh, no. Hopefully nothing will break down, right?
Yeah, really. Then I'm really in trouble.
Well, it would seem that that probably wouldn't hold if once the body had totally decayed. It wouldn't hold when a body was vaporized like an
right dust when it turns into dust.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think that isn't the case because if we were conscious even when our bodies were dead, that would suggest that the consciousness wasn't dependent on the physical being. And if that were the case, why would it hang around?
Good point. Good point.
So, at any rate. Some people have argued that extrasensory perception isn't a good term. They'll say, the senses have to be involved because the perceptual processes require stimulation by the senses in order for them to function. Well, if you make that definition or if you make that assumption, that's true. But in fact, with remote viewing, and this is where we'll get back to RV and dowsing, with remote viewing, in fact, you do seem to have sensory experiences, but it is very evident that the senses involved were not stimulated. In remote viewing, you can perceive colors, you can perceive shapes, you can perceive patterns visually, and yet you know for absolute certain that your eyes did not perceive those colors, patterns, and shapes. So that does seem to be outside of the senses and yet be a perceptual kind of a function.
How close is remote viewing, Paul, to time travel?
Well, I guess that depends on what you mean by time travel. If you think in terms of like H.G. Wells, the guy getting in the machine.
No machine. The machine's your mind, let's say, or the subhuman consciousness.
Well, in the respect of consciousness traveling in time, which again, remember, we've just established that it's not exclusively a physical phenomenon. That consciousness involves something that can transcend at least physics as we understand it. Then remote viewing is very much a time travel phenomenon. Now, your consciousnesses do seem quite capable of traveling in time, backward, and also to some degree forward. And so in that sense, it is time travel.
I think so, too. I really do. And if you're really perfected, you probably go any place you want.
I think that's true. Any time, well, place you want, certainly. Any time you want. You certainly could do that as well, to a degree. Now, I've talked before that the future has some limitations, being able to travel in the future, but that's a long discussion we don't necessarily need to get into at the moment.
Okay, but now back to the similarities, yeah, though, between remote viewing and dowsing.
Yeah. Okay, so that is one of the kind of breakthrough things that have been started to be discovered in the Fort Meade Military Unit and also with help from the research folks. But now in the process of putting all of this together recently, really have become quite clear. You can, in fact, trace or explain a lot of what happens in dowsing the same way you explain it in using remote viewing theory. In fact, you'd mentioned the course that I've been working on. We do that in the course. We explain to the necessary detail to learn the process that, in fact, we use remote viewing theory to explain how dowsing works to a great extent. And we've tied the two together. What that also means, though, is that some of the things we found to lessen the problems you run into with the conscious-subconscious interaction remote viewing, we've been able to apply those to the dowsing process as well, which means that the chances of being accurate with dowsing have gone up. If you learn the process properly and you manage the noise, that's one of the big factors of remote viewing is the mental noise that gets in the way. Well, mental noise affects dowsing as well. And once you become aware of it and once you learn how to deal with it, actually, it enhances your chances of being successful with dowsing.
All right, now let's talk for a bit here, Paul, about dowsing. And give me, if you can, some successful examples of how it is used.
Okay. You want the examples now?
Of course.
Oh, okay. I thought we were talking about something else. That's good. Okay. Examples.
Keep you 5 hours tonight.
That's fine with me.
Maybe. It depends on what kind of mood I'm in.
I'll have to talk to my wife and they'll let me sleep a little later.
Nah, I'll let you go. Don't worry.
No, that's fine. I'll talk as long as you want me to. Let me go back again a bit into the past, and I'll tell you some of the exciting things that were done with it at Fort Meade, and not just at Fort Meade, but also out at SRI. One of the more, probably one of the more interesting instances, and I touch on this in my book, although not in great detail, was it seems that we say remote viewing, but actually it involves the search methodology that essentially is dowsing, that may have played a major role in ending the shell game strategy for the MX missile basing, which most people probably don't remember that or have been born since that happened. But remember, back in the late 70s, the Air Force and the U.S. government in the Carter administration was trying to figure out how they were going to base the latest and most powerful nuclear missile that we had ever developed, then known as the MX, now known as the Peace.
Okay, I vaguely remember that.
Yeah. Well, the idea was that and the problem is that you don't want the enemy to be able to target your missiles because then you can't strike back if they attack you. It gets into a really convoluted nuclear war.
Well, probably one of the reasons why, you know, the Soviets at the time started into this, and so did we.
Yeah. Well, and that was the idea. We wanted to be able to take out their missile systems so that we didn't have to attack their cities. We didn't want to blow up a bunch of people. We just wanted to stop them from being able to blow us up.
Right.
Well, the Soviets kind of had the same idea. They wanted to take out our missiles because then that would leave us helpless in a nuclear exchange. Well, we were building these missiles, and if we put them in silos like the Minutemen and Atlas and all those that were already in silos, then the Soviets, those were fixed positions. The Soviets could knock them out. So somebody came up with this great idea. They called, I think they called it the, no, they call it the shell game theory, right, or shell game strategy, where they would build these shelters in the desert, in the Great Basin, and then they would have these covered trailers or these covered railway cars, and they would shuttle the mission between the missile between four or five of these shelters, and the Soviets would never know which one the missile was actually in, right? And it seemed like a really good idea at the time. Of course, the one thing they didn't think about was then that would mean the Soviets not being able to hit our missiles would then have to hit our cities after all. So, essentially, we were holding our population hostage to keep our missiles protected, which seems like a dumb idea today.
Yeah.
But it turned out it didn't matter because the SRI, Hal Puthoff and the other folks there, ran some simulations using remote viewers, essentially actually using a dowsing process. They presented a number of possible locations. This was done on a computer, but it would work even regular physically on the ground. They presented a bunch of locations where the missile, in quotes, could possibly be located. And then the dowser / remote viewer was supposed to then try and pick which one they intuited where it was, right? Their intuition would tell them which shelter it was.
Right.
And then they assembled all those, and they did some error-correcting protocols on it and stuff. And what it boiled down to is, then in just about every case, the search process that they were using, the ESP search process they were using, located where the missile was. And since it was known that the Soviets had remote viewers and had a ESP program, the conclusion was that using that, the shell game theory would not work. Because they could pinpoint where our missiles were and fire on them and get them. So they just went back to the drawing board.
Start all over again.
Essentially, yeah. There were other reasons, obviously, why the program was canceled, but there is a really strong suspicion that because the report did go up to DOD. It definitely went up the channels. And there's strong suspicion that may have contributed to ending that really kind of crazy basing idea for the MX missile, which involved literally billions of dollars.
Some people, you know, when they hear the word dowsing, get that old-time impression that we just talked about,
mm-hmm.
right? The old farmer walking around looking for water and stuff. When we come back at the top of the hour, Paul, tell us how can we use this in our day-to-day lives to truly benefit ourselves? You know, I mean, can some people use it for stock picks, a better job, a better love life? Can you use it that way?
Well, maybe.
How do you use it?
Well,
I mean, we all know you're worth $10 or $20 million just because of all this, right?
Maybe I should start using it more. how do I use it? Well, I use it oftentimes. I use it to find things, which, you know, okay, duh, that's what dowsing's for, right? Just to find.
What do you mean to find things? Your car keys?
Car keys. I've done that. I've got some great stories. Now, obviously, fairly trivial. I'm happy to tell those stories.
I got to write this down for next hour. Paul finds car keys.
Car keys, okay. Yes. I'll tell you a couple of very interesting stories about car keys.
All right, hold on, Paul. We'll be right back with you at the top of the hour. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.